Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. No, we are not at home. These are not our various living rooms or bedrooms. We are in our Augusta rental house on the eve of Masters Week. Rex, we will not get into the bad golf we played because there was plenty of good golf that we needed to discuss, beginning, of course, with Valero Texas Open, where Akshay Bhatia, 22-year-old, won his second PGA Tour event and punched his ticket to the Masters, beating Denny McCarthy in a playoff. Poor Denny McCarthy. He has been longing for his maiden PGA Tour victory. All he does in the back nine is shoot 28, rip off seven consecutive birdies, put up a performance, and I just saw a stat from a data guru in which he was 21-plus strokes gained for the tournament. That would have won 167 consecutive events on the PGA Tour. The only problem with that is that Akshay Bhatia is the player who won in San Antonio. What was your reaction to a frenetic Sunday finish on the PGA Tour and Akshay Bhatia now becoming the first player who performed in the drive, chip, and putt competition to play in the Masters?
Yeah, that's really cool. And we had talked about that stat earlier in the week, but now I don't want to gloss over you, right? I don't want to talk about the bad golf we play, but I do want to thank Brooks Blackburn at Palmetto Golf Club for having us. It's one of the highlights of the year for both of us. We went and got in not quite 15 and a half. We hit tee shots on 16 and then walked away because we were so disgusted. It was fun listening to it as we played on Sirius XM radio because I did not expect it to be a very exciting afternoon. It seemed like Akshay had such a commanding lead that he was going to run away with this, that no one was going to be able to catch him. And he actually shot, I think he shot 68 in the final round, right? Or 69. He shot 300 in the final round.
67 in the final round. Danny McCarthy shot 63. And Akshay made a birdie on the first playoff hole to get the title.
And you would have thought, given the commanding lead that he had, if you shoot 67 on Sunday, you're going to win pretty easily. But you're right. When you look at what Denny McCarthy did, and you and I were talking about this on the golf course, and having been in San Antonio for a couple of days before I came over to Augusta National, I was taken on Thursday and Friday with how every time I would interview Denny McCarthy, who I would not expect to be filled with confidence as far as winning because you haven't done it on the PGA Tour. I understand the need to have self-confidence. I understand the need to have self-belief. But there was a irrational amount of confidence coming from him. Every time I talked to him on Thursday and Friday, it was like, of course, I shot a good round today.
Shoot or shoot, baby.
I know. That was it. I mean, it was kind of like, let my boy cook, and this is what I'm going to do. And even on Friday afternoon when I talked to him and he bogeyed the last hole and he was kind of a little upset, which is understandable. But even in that context, it was like, look, man, I got the bad side of the draw, which he did. If you kind of break it down statistically, you can look at it. He did get the bad side of the draw. And he goes, and I'm still right there. I can still make a move. And that's what he did. It is shocking to look at what Denny McCarthy has done in his career and the fact that he hasn't won. And I think it's a testament to what you and I talk about on this podcast a lot, about the idea that it's easy to dismiss how difficult it is to win on the PGA Tour. That if you have a guy like Tiger Woods who wins at such a clip that he did at the height of his powers, that he made it look easy. And in fact, like winning on tour is hard. It doesn't matter if it's at the Texas Open or this week at the Masters. It's really, really hard to get everything to go your way, to have your game on form for not one, but 4 days. And you really can't have an off day. And Akshay did not have an off day. And it's amazing that as dominant as he was to start the week, he started the week with a dominant round, just like Denny McCarthy finished the week with a dominant round. And he finished strong with a 67, as you just pointed out, and still had to, you know, do it in a playoff. And so that part's the amazing thing to me.
Yeah. I mean, Denny McCarthy has made some pretty immense strides in his career. He was always just known as a great putter who was a really kind of shoddy ball striker. And over the past couple of years, he's gained a lot of distance. He's gained a lot of speed. His proximity to the hole, his approach play is much, much better. I mean, his tee to green stats, obviously second only to Akshay Bhatia, he gained more than 13 and a half shots on the field, tee to green. Denny McCarthy had never done that in a tournament on a golf course at TPC San Antonio, which traditionally is very, very difficult. The scores that this year, those two guys kind of ran away.
It was so hard with the wind blowing.
Rory was third at 11 under par. That's traditionally where you see the winning score at the Valero Texas Open each and every year. I think it's just an indication of the quality of play that these two had. As it relates to the winner, Akshay Bhatia, very interesting player, 22 years old, obviously eschewed the college ranks to turn professional, had a really kind of rocky start to his professional career. Now at still what is a very young age of 22, now PGA Tour, two PGA Tour victories, won the Barracuda about a year and a half ago, and now gets the Texas Open, which gets him in to the Masters. You had an opportunity to catch up with him both Thursday and Friday, being on the call for Golf Channel and NBC from the Texas Open. What were your impressions of Akshay? Because it seems like a player who is coming into his own, and although he's kind of learning on the fly what it means to be a professional and be a PGA Tour player, it also seems like he's just so much more mature than he was a couple years ago.
Well, and I guess that stands to reason. You're right. I would agree with that 100%. But he's 22 years old. And it seems like he's been around for a couple of years now. It's not like we're just hearing about him now. I mean, we knew about him as soon as he turned pro. And all the
17-year-old, I believe he was when he turned pro.
Yeah. 17. Like, yeah. So he's been a pro for half a decade, and he's just 22 years old. And he's won for the second time on the PGA Tour. I was taken by his comments this week. And look, we're probably going to dig into this in the weeks to come. But he needed to figure out some stuff off the golf course. He talked about, when I interviewed him, dealing with anxieties, dealing with pressures, dealing with things that he put on himself. Like all of the things that a normal 22-year-old would deal with. But now you're a 22-year-old in the spotlight, and you're expected to perform, and you're expected to be good week in and week out. Like, that comes with an extra set of just pressures. I have a middle child that's about to turn 21 next week. And I can only imagine what it would be like for Trevor — that's who we're talking about here — for Trevor just show up at a PGA Tour event and immediately be expected to win. Like you need to perform week in and week out. Like, the expectations are so high. I can only empathize on what the pressures must be in that situation. I can only empathize with the anxiety that he must have been feeling. And he talked a lot about that this week. If you go back to the transcripts, the things he said to me during the telecast, it is interesting that his commitment to being a better person, a better minded person off the golf course, has now led to this result on the golf course. And I think there's probably a lesson to be learned there, because I think a lot of players, if they get in a slump, if they're not playing the way they want to, the knee jerk reaction is, okay, I just need to practice more. I just need to focus on the parts of my game that aren't working. Where very rarely does someone have the maturity or, you know, the frame of mind to be able to say, I probably just need to get in a better headspace off the golf course, and that will translate to better results on the golf course. But in this particular case, that's exactly what happened with Akshay.
I mean, he's an immensely talented player, always has been. We were just talking, our colleague Brentley Romine is here. We drove past Graniteville, South Carolina, which is where the prestigious Sage Valley Invitational is held. He's like, yep, Akshay won there just a couple years ago. Like, he's always been a winner. He's always been a player for whom much was expected. And you could talk about the various parts of his game. Like, he's basically a left-handed Dustin Johnson, kind of his carefree nature. It's the ball just jumps off his club face, like a very, very pure ball striker. You can talk about his move to the broomstick putter. He was one of the worst putters on the PGA Tour last year. I think he was like outside the top 180 in strokes gained putting. Moves to the broomstick putter, which has become so popular on the PGA Tour over the last year, and now he's a top 50 putter on the PGA Tour, just clutch putt after clutch putt, both in regulation to actually match Danny McCarthy, and then winning putt in the playoff as well. From the physical standpoint, like, all the gifts are there, but I thought it was very revealing the way that Akshay talked about some of the struggles that he's had. He appeared very vulnerable to me, Rex. Yeah. You know, mentioning, I think he said he talked to his sports psychologist four or five times on the phone over the past 24 or 48 hours, just trying to get into the proper headspace to win this golf tournament. And yes, it was a bit of a unique situation. You know, he had such a big lead. He was leading wire to wire. There was so much expected of him. There was kind of so many perks that would come with this victory and getting into the Masters, getting into the signature events for the rest of the season, improving his world ranking as he did. But he said he's had a lot of struggles kind of running his own race, which was the phrase that his sports psychologist used with him. This should help him immensely. Just kind of relax, kind of settle in. You mentioned the difficulty of being 22 on the PGA Tour when it seems like so many of the top players are kind of entrenched in that 26 to 32 year old zone, where they're, you know, they either have families or they're married and kind of have their lives established. Well, although Akshay is now engaged, he's just trying to find his footing on the PGA Tour. I'm sure that's a very uncomfortable position for him to be. But I do hope that this brings him a little bit of peace, a little bit of kind of validation that Akshay Bhatia is on the right track, because he's immensely talented. I think he's a huge boon to the PGA Tour and could become a superstar if he continues on this trajectory. Obviously, Rex, we have to talk too about Rory McIlroy, especially with the Masters up ahead. Rory, you talked to him all week in San Antonio, finishes third, his first top 10 on the PGA Tour, at least this season. I know he was very concerned about what this would mean for his FedEx Cup rank for the rest of the season. This does move him now inside the top 50. What do you make of Rory's four rounds and sort of the momentum that he now brings into the year's first major?
I think there is momentum. And we talked about this last week about the idea that, look, I have a huge amount of respect because of everything he has changed going into this Masters. Because it's really, really easy for a player to decide, oh, okay, this is the way I'm going to prepare for a major, and just stick with it because you think that's what's right with you. In Rory's case, he has tried everything over the last decade, and he continues to try everything. He's not going to leave a stone unturned in this quest to make sure he gets the career Grand Slam, and that's winning the Masters. And that's the one that's eluded him. So I'll give him a ton of credit. I'm not quite sure it's going to work out this time, because you look at everything he's done, visiting, going to Butch Harmon last week, just trying to get a second set of eyes, taking the scouting trip this week on Monday and Tuesday before he went to San Antonio to get in that extra practice at Augusta National. The plan is not to show up here at Augusta until Tuesday afternoon-ish. And he's going to play nine holes, or at least that's what he told me, nine holes on Tuesday and then nine holes on Wednesday. He's not going to play the par three. Like everything that he has done to sort of wash this slate clean and to see if I can come up with a better way of doing this, because the way he's been doing it hasn't worked up until this point. I think this is probably the best case scenario, because, and we were talking about this last week at the tournament with some of the folks who were on the call with John Wood and some other folks. Steve Sands was in on this conversation about him winning in San Antonio. Probably it wasn't the best case scenario in a weird way. I know everyone's going to roll their eyes when I say something like that, but I mean, winning on the PGA Tour takes a toll. It takes a mental and a physical toll on you. And Tiger Woods made it look like, again, it was easy, so he could win in San Antonio, and then he would show up at Augusta, and you would expect him, oh, he's going to do it again. But it's really hard to do that for a lot of different reasons. So I think that's
the last time Rory won a major, he won the week before.
Well, and I'm not even saying
Firestone, they won the PGA.
But finishing with a 66, which, you know, he shot even par on Saturday, which was not great, but finishing with a 66 is probably the best case scenario, because now he knows, and it's just not a 66 on its face. It's what he was able to do with his approach shots, and that's been the problem. So that's why he went to work with Butch Harmon. That's why he was trying to figure out, like, the driving is what makes Rory McIlroy great. Like, I think he was second in the field in strokes gained off the tee, and he started gaining strokes on the field on Sunday with his approach shots. If he can carry that over to Augusta National, which we all know is a second shot golf course, then yes, I really like his chances. But the fact of the matter remains, like, it's going to be really hard for him to do it at this point in his career, and it's not going to get any easier.
Now, when you and I had a little tiff on Wednesday on the Golf Channel podcast,
I'm glad you brought that up.
People were very upset.
I know.
People thought, you know, we're really going after each other. That's how we talk off camera. That's certainly how we try to talk on the podcast, where we're just, that's basically a reflection of our true selves. We do have spirited golf discussion. You took exception with the idea that whatever Rory did in San Antonio would not eventually mean anything for his Masters chances. I took exception with that a little bit, because I think this could not have worked out better for Rory and what he actually saw in San Antonio. Two bogey-free rounds on a golf course that can be very penal, that can be pretty punishing in the right conditions, and the approach play, like you mentioned, the proximity of the hole was much, much tighter than it has. There was no way that the Rory McIlroy that we saw coming off the Players' Championship and how disappointed he was there had any chance to win the Masters. It was too untidy. He had the misses. He had so much self-doubt with the driver swing and the iron swing in sort of the shot pattern that he was going to see coming off of his club face. That's why he went to go see Butch Harmon, to get some validation or to get some confirmation of the direction that he was heading on. And the way that he played in San Antonio with a much tighter dispersion, missing on the proper side of the golf course, he, in his words, playing much smarter golf. That is exactly what you want to see heading into a major championship. Just more control of the golf ball. I think as Rory flies on his jet, now not to Augusta, but to back home for 36 to 48 hours, I think he has to be in a much better headspace than he was when he left TPC Sawgrass just a couple of weeks ago.
Sure. And there's no doubting that. However, I would still counter and say if he finished third or 33rd, like I don't know that his odds in my mind are different simply because we've seen.
I would put him, I think, Scotty's in his own tier, and we'll get into this later this week in the actual preview podcast. I would bump Rory up a couple spots in tier two, based on the way that he played, some of the momentum, and I think just sort of the positivity of the week.
He was going to be in tier two regardless, at least in my mind. You can talk it through. Like, so Scotty, I agree. He's up there in his own category. However, when you do Rory, when you do John Rahm, and we can go down the list of whoever else you want
Xander
to put in there.
I'll put Xander in there.
Well, I knew you were going to put Xander in there. I'm not quite sure if I buy that one. And this isn't personal. Like, I hate to do this with Xander because I do like his game and I do like him as a person, but I don't know that he deserves to be in the second tier simply because he's never really done anything.
Such are the stats.
Wait, why did your voice go up so high? What's happening?
Because it's a ridiculous point.
All right, try it in your TV voice, and then maybe I'll believe you.
Give the stats.
There it is.
That's the one.
The stats. The stats. He hasn't won a major. I think he's only contended probably legitimately twice off the top of my head.
Including at Augusta National, the year that Tiger won.
Like, I'm not even saying that he can't win here. He absolutely can win. Like, we've been sitting around waiting, and we continue to sit around and wait. And I think you picked him to be the player of the year the last 2 years.
I mean, I've picked him to win a major ever since he popped on the scene at the 2017 U.S. Open. I've picked him to win at least one major every single year to this point that has not been fruitful. And yes, Xander Schauffele was my pick for 2023 PGA Tour Player of the Year, and he did not have a single victory. So I will continue to believe in Xander Schauffele, even if that love is to this point unrequited.
And I pick Colin Morikawa to be the biggest disappointment, and he's yet to fall out of the top 20. So it shows you, like, you can be wrong. I mean, I'm not even like trying to pick on you here. I don't want to cause another thing because everyone was worried about that we got snippy at each other on Wednesday. Trust me, we played golf together tonight. We got snippy at each other constantly, but that doesn't mean that we still don't share a house and we still don't enjoy each other's company. I will say that yes, this helps in my mind Rory's chances this week for all the reasons you just said, not because he finished third. It's how he finished third on a really, really difficult golf course and driving the ball well, putting it in play, which you have to do at TPC San Antonio. But he was third in the field in strokes game approach. And you're right. That's the vast difference between where he was just a couple of weeks ago at the Players Championship and where you want to be heading into this particular competition, because it's a second shot golf course. And if you can find a way to put the ball in the right section of the green, and that's not necessarily next to the hole a lot of times. Like, that's the part that sort of throws people off. It's sometimes you have to intentionally steer away from some of these hole locations because that's where you get in trouble going after those pins. If he can find a way to do that, I absolutely love it. I will say this, and I got in this conversation. I was doing a radio interview on Saturday on my way over from Atlanta when I flew here, and someone asked me that if Rory gets to the end of his career and he doesn't have the career grand slam, will that be, however you want to put it, an objective failure? And in my mind, and I'm not even trying to be the apologist here, but when you and I speak of Arnold Palmer, the late, great Arnold Palmer, the first thing we go to is that, he didn't get that PGA championship. Like, he never finished the career grand slam. We've never started a conversation about Arnold Palmer that way. So I understand it's a little bit different with Rory just because of the history at this particular golf course. I mean, he should have won a decade ago, and things just unraveled on the back nine, and we all know what happened. And then
second nine, that's $5.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so, there's going to be a lot of money in that pot at the end of this week. I can feel it already. I can feel it already. I might as well just throw the whatever money I have for dancing for my dinner.
I mean, I'm completely with you. I don't agree with that premise at all. I do think at this point, Rory would just take any major. He would obviously prefer it to be this major to complete the career Grand Slam. But I think
In your heart of hearts, if we're having this conversation 20 or 30 years from now, I don't think the first thing we go to with Rory is, too bad, didn't get that major, didn't get a green jacket. Because we don't with Arnold Palmer.
No, if he picks off another PGA championship, maybe two PGA championships, Valhalla is going to be a great chance for him in just a month's time. If he picks off another Open championship, if he gets to six, maybe seven major championships, and he does not win a green jacket at a course that does seem tailor-made for his skill set, yeah. Would it be disappointing? Would it be an abject failure? Absolutely not. I wouldn't agree with that premise at all. If he does not go on to win another major championship, then I think that's a different conversation. But Rory's 34, 35 years old with still probably 3 to 4 prime years left in him. Let's give him the benefit of time.
That's all you think he has less is 3 to 4?
Of prime years? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I'd say closer
to 7 or 8.
So you think Rory McIlroy is going to be hyper competitive in his early 40s, swinging the way he does with the bye that he has?
Well, what are you getting at with that? I don't understand. Yes, I feel
swinging
like
swinging extremely violently, which tends to take a toll on the body the later and the older that you get.
He's probably the best conditioned athlete on the PGA Tour right now. So no, I don't think the physical toll, because I think
a matter of conditioning. It's a matter of the torque that he's able to put on his body at that age. Eventually,
when he sat down with Smiley for the happy hour on Friday, he talked about some of the things he can't do. And this is what Brandon Chamblee brought up a few months ago now, is because in 2017, I guess he hurt a rib. And it's funny that this is the first kind of we've heard about it. Like we never heard about it in 2017 or the years since then, but he can't get into the positions that he wants to because of this injury. He can kind of feel it. But that is the only thing I've ever heard him sort of refer to as an issue. And I think we can all look at his swing and say, technically, I don't think anyone's going to pick it apart and say there's something wrong. Well, maybe Brandon would. But I think if you watch his swing in slow motion, we can all go, that's the way I'd like to swing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how he got off on this tangent. I think it's unrealistic to expect that Rory McIlroy in his early 40s would be swinging the same way that he's swinging now with his speed and the amount of torque and torsions that he's putting on his body. I think some sort of compensations would have to be made.
Let's do the sports radio thing real quick. And is he already a Hall of Famer? In my mind, yes.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. All right. Yeah. Like, you don't have this, but he would be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so, again, I keep going back to the idea that we're going to fixate on this year in and year out when it comes to Rory.
How about this? I think Rory is a Hall of Famer based on what he's done post-2014, which is when he last won a major championship.
Well, that would be a different conversation, but if Colin Morikawa, not Colin Morikawa, if Colin Montgomery is in the Hall of Fame, then yes, I can see where you're coming from for that. And look, this is based on different things. It's based on winning the Order of Merit in Europe. It's based on Ryder Cup performance. Like, I get it.
Rory is a Hall of Famer based on what he's done since 2014. He's basically had two Hall of Fame careers. That is how I would put it. Speaking of sports radio discussion, Rex, here's a fun one that's going to put you on the spot. Jordan Spieth, you believe in his Masters chances, or do you not, based on his T10 finish at the Valero Texas Open?
Yeah, I like his chances better than I did at the beginning of last week, because it looked like I watched
all of a sudden
play.
Now it does matter what happens in Texas. Make up your mind.
Like, I watched him play. Does it matter or does it not? I watched him play. Maybe again, these are very Jordan-esque rounds, and this is what we come to expect from him. But even I was taken by the idea of he gets a hole in one, and this was in his round. And I just want to go back and make sure I have this right. So in round one, he starts on the first hole and he goes bogey, par, par, bogey, birdie, birdie, bogey, par, bogey. So it's a very Jordan round. And then he adds two more, a bogey and a birdie to start the second nine. And then he makes a 7, a double bogey at the par 5 14th hole. and then he finishes 1-3-5. Like that, I don't know how, like if you just looked it up online and you're like, show me in visual form what a Jordan Spieth round looks like, you would put that card up because you're like,
perfect encapsulation of who he is as a player.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny. I was talking with his parents on Friday afternoon, and even they were just flummoxed. And I would argue, regardless of what happened in San Antonio, if he missed the cut or finished tied for 10th, which is what he ended up doing, I still like his chances at Augusta, because this goes back to institutional knowledge. We all know he can play this golf course well. It just depends on how comfortable he is with his game. I don't think he's very comfortable with his game right now, but he's doing Jordan Spieth type things in between really, really weird, ugly things. And so if he can find a way, like Rory has done, to clean up the really, really ugly things and just do the Jordan Spieth type things, then yeah, you have to like his chances. But I don't, like, let's go back to tiers. You're not putting him in that second tier.
I would put him probably at the bottom of the second tier or at the very top of the third tier. I mean, I like a player who's making a ton of birdies, which is what Jordan Spieth is doing. And he made, I think, 19 birdies and an eagle over 4 days at the Valero Texas Open. Yeah. Did he make a ton of mistakes? Absolutely. He made 11 bogeys. He made two doubles. Like that's it's just way too sloppy and untidy. But when you get to a golf course like Augusta National, that he does know where the misses are, where he can rely on his short game, which has been stellar in 2024. And he can rely on the putter, which he really couldn't over the past couple of years as he was trying to build that back up to 2017 levels. I actually really like Jordan Spieth this week at the Masters. Do I think he's playing well enough to overtake Scottie Scheffler? No, Scottie Scheffler is still my pick to win the Masters. I think he could win by a handful of shots, but I'd be very surprised based on the way that Jordan Spieth is playing right now and based on his course history, if Jordan Spieth was not at least very much in the picture on the weekend. I'll put it like that. Rex, although we were not able to watch the final round of the Live Miami event, that's not because we're Live haters, but because our attention needed to be elsewhere. What did you make of how the folks like Jon Rahm fared, Brooks Koepka, Joaquin Niemann, Dustin Johnson, Bryson DeChambeau, potentially players like that, who I think many of us figure on the Live side can contend for this Masters title?
I mean, I would give them, again, a monsoon of credit for playing Doral the week before this particular event.
Great move.
Because it seems to fit into the schedule better. I think Brooks Koepka said this is the first big boy course that they've played all year long. It's a true test. It gave them, all of them, whether if it's Jon Rahm or Phil or whoever else, a chance to actually measure their game on or tour caliber golf course compared to some of the other places that they play. I will be curious. And again, we keep going back to this idea. Like Jon Rahm is clearly going to be in that second tier. Like it's not even a debate. Actually, you could probably make an argument that maybe he should be in the first tier right alongside of Scottie Scheffler. Like now you're just kind of splitting hairs on that front. And I think as you go down the line, like, I don't know why you wouldn't pick Brooks. Like I have a hard time wrapping my mind around it. Cause as we've discussed, I can't quantify him against the field, against the analytics, against everything that we normally do, all the things that we just did for the last 30 minutes, talking about Rory, talking about Akshay, talking about Jordan Spieth, like all of the things we can do to sort of say, okay, this is why I think he's going to play well here. It's really, really hard for me to do that with the Live guys because we don't have those advanced analytics. We don't have the ability to compare them against fields that we know are pretty good. Like I'm not doing that to the Live fields. Like they obviously there are still world-class players out there, but there's players that probably aren't playing their best, just like there's players that aren't playing their best on the PGA Tour. So I would put Brooks, I would put Jon Rahm in that second category, maybe even DJ, although, you know, I haven't seen a whole bunch of results wise from him. After that, I think that the other guys kind of fade a little bit.
To me, I think there's two big question marks for the Live players. Not worried at all about Jon Rahm. I think he'll play well because Jon Rahm always plays well. But the two question marks for me are Cam Smith, who WD'd, I believe he had a stomach bug or food poisoning, some sort of illness, saved himself to try and gear up for the Masters and get healthy that way. He has not done what we're used to seeing from Cam Smith. I would say not just throughout the live season, but it's kind of like an ongoing trend, I would say, probably since last year's U.S. Open, with a top 10 finish as well. But the other player is Brooks Koepka. Brooks Koepka, I think you always say, like, I'm out of the Tiger Woods doubting business. I think we have to be kind of a similar mindset when it comes to Brooks Koepka, where past performance is not necessarily an indicator of what he's going to do when a major championship comes around, when he gets focused, when he plays the type of golf that we've come to expect from him. But there has not been much, Rex, in terms of form from Brooks Koepka in 2024 at all. Just a single top 10 finish, had a really bad week at Doral, finished outside the top 40. He talked in his pre-tournament press conference about how once March 1st rolls around, that's when he locks in. That's sort of his time of year, and whatever else happened before, that doesn't really matter, and it's all about gearing up in the month of March to get where he wants to go. We haven't seen sort of that payoff. Last year was an entirely different story, if you recall. He won the event at Orange County National in Orlando the week prior to the Masters, then came to the Masters and was 18 holes away from winning his first green jacket before he got run over by John Rahm on that marathon Sunday. We have not sort of seen that elevation in form that Brooks Koepka wants to see as well, where he's ramping up. And so to me, he is a huge question mark as it relates to the year's first major. Data Golf, which takes into account not just the official world golf ranking, but also can do strokes gain metric for the live performances as well. They have Brooks Koepka as the 44th ranked player in the world right now. Similar players are Denny McCarthy, Louis Oosthuizen, Cam Smith, coincidentally enough, Chris Kirk. That's sort of the level that Brooks Koepka is playing to currently. That feels, I think, more appropriate than just slotting him in as number 3, 4, 5 favorite for your list of Masters contenders.
7 over. Par at Doral through 3 rounds. And again, it's not a major championship. And we all, to your point, like, we know that he has a different gear, that when he shows up at the majors, certainly this major would qualify for that. He finds something special and has a history of proving everybody wrong on that front. I would be curious. Sergio Garcia lost a playoff. And I don't know that I would have Sergio Garcia. And again, I don't know how we're going to do tiers or categories here, but I don't know if I would have him in my top 3 or 4 categories, but he has won here before, and he's clearly.
But he basically—I mean—he hasn't done anything else besides that. I mean, the 2017 Masters performance.
Okay, again, this goes to the analytics that we don't have when it comes to these players.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I think Sergio has a love-hate relationship with Augusta National. Has not played that golf course outside of 2017. Very well at all, particularly in the last 6 or 7 years since winning the green jacket. And so I think it'll be very curious to see, because I mean, Sergio's actually played some good golf. If this was a Ryder Cup year, and Sergio Garcia was now 4 or 5 months away from potentially playing on the European Ryder Cup team, he's probably a player that you'd want to have on. He's now lost in 2 playoffs on the live schedule. He still obviously keeps in great shape for being in his early to mid 40s. He's playing some really good golf, and you would think with his history as sort of an elite ball striker and obviously his history as a match play player, if you're Luke Donald, you would be thinking, once again, I probably need to find a way to get Sergio Garcia on my team as it relates to the Masters and his history there. I think there's more that needs to be overcome. He has done nothing since winning the green jacket in 2017. I don't expect that to change at all this year. Rex, you and I do not cover the LPGA. We cover the world of golf. We keep our eyes on things that are happening in the world of golf. But we do need to mention Nelly Korda, world number one, who just ripped off her 4th consecutive victory on the LPGA. Unlike the other three, this was actually a match play tournament. A tournament at Shadow Creek, in which she did not start well, and yet she got through the cut, and then ripped through the match play bracket as well, beating European Solheim Cup stalwart Leona Maguire in the process. The first player since Lorena Ochoa in 2008 to win four consecutive tournaments, and the first American since Nancy Lopez in 1978 to win four consecutive tournaments. Rex, will the golf world stand up and take notice of Nelly Korda ripping off four in a row as we enter the first major championship of the year, the Chevron Championship, the week after the Masters?
Before you even got there, I'd already pulled up, like, I'm reading the story on the LPGA's website, just because I was curious. Like, it is amazing that we're at this inflection point right now in sports. Like, you and I both sat up this afternoon and watched the NCAA tournament finish up. Iowa lost to South Carolina. I think, like a lot of people, we were captivated by the entire tournament. And I think you could say the same thing about women's soccer and across the board. I think women's sports have become much more captivating than they ever been, even more so than men's sports. And again, this goes to, I would argue that what we saw today between Iowa and South Carolina is probably going to be more entertaining. It's going to be more riveting. It's going to resonate with fans much more than what we'll probably see Monday night with the men's finals. Not saying that's right or wrong. That just seems the way we're tracking right now. I'm curious why this hasn't taken on a foothold, because you're right. This is historic what she's doing, and she doesn't seem to have any interest in slowing down. I will be fascinated in the next coming weeks to find out, because I think they have a major in 2 weeks in Houston. Like, can she continue this pace? This is a Tiger-esque pace. And if that happens, will we see the same sort of boost, let's call it, that we've seen in other women's sports that suddenly elevate this not just to a new level, but does it elevate it beyond the men's game? And when we consider where the men's game is right now, you and I have talked about this ad nauseum, the idea that there is fan fatigue, that people don't want to hear about how much purses are, how much guys are getting guaranteed. They don't want to hear about equity shares. They don't want to hear about deals. They want to see the best players playing against each other. I can imagine a scenario where 3 or 4 weeks from now, if she continues this historic pace, that the women's game starts to draw more attention than the men's game. And I don't think we've ever seen that before.
Yeah, I mean, the LPGA is desperate for a dominant player, and who better to be the dominant player on the LPGA than Nelly Korda, a 26-year-old American. She's tall, she's blonde, she's athletic, she hits it far. I mean, we were always longing for a player like Lexi Thompson to kind of take that mantle and be kind of the charismatic player who would bring fans in droves, and everyone wanted to see her, who's just this decorated champion. That has not come to fruition. Lexi Thompson has not won the LPGA in nearly 5 years. Nelly Korda is becoming that player right before our eyes. Four in a row, this has not happened in 17 years. It has not happened for an American since 1978. It's phenomenal. I think if this was a different time of year, Rex, I think more people would be paying attention to what Nelly Korda has done. I don't think the LPGA schedule has done her any favors. Like, Nelly Korda took off 7 weeks from the first event that she played in 2024, went on vacation, and now she's ripped off three in a row before finally getting a break before the year's first major. If this was during the summer, if this was during the fall, perhaps where attention wasn't so divided between either the Masters or March Madness, I think this would take a stronger foothold. But I think the Chevron Championship just ratcheted up in importance even more, because I think fans are now curious to see, what do we have going on here? Yeah. Is this going to be an Annika Sorenstam type season where she wins 8, 9, 10 times on the LPGA? Or is this just a hot streak by a very talented American player? I think everyone's hoping it's the former.
Well, and look, man, full disclosure, you and I cover the men's game, and so sometimes we are guilty of being myopic and not paying attention to any other parts of the game, whether that's amateur golf or the LPGA, whatever the case may be. In this particular case, I'll go back, and you mentioned Annika. That's probably a good comp. The one that immediately came to mind for me was Imbi Park, when she was going essentially for the Grand Slam, and she was doing it, if I'm not mistaken, at St. Andrews, right, at the Women's Open Championship. And I remember talking to our colleague Doug Ferguson from the AP. And look, Doug's schedule is very much like yours and mine. Like, he covers men's golf primarily, and he hit those majors and those big events are where he was going to go. And I remember him telling me, like, I've got to change my schedule. I have to be there for this. Like, this is a historic moment. I can imagine something very, very similar. And to your point, and not to be again, myopic or chauvinistic or whatever the case may be. But you're right. This is an American. She's tall. She's easy to watch on TV. All the things you could sit here and say, like, this could possibly resonate if she continues this run.
Can't believe Emby Park. I can't believe that was in 2013 where Emby Park won the first three major
championships that long ago? Of the year. Curious,
yeah. Boy, God, that seems just a couple years ago. Apparently, it was not. Rex, this is the eve of Masters Week. I've been here since Friday, covering the Augusta National Women's Amateur. As always, a phenomenal tournament. Congrats to Lottie Woad, or as our friend Mark Schlabaugh, the Bulldog of ESPN, Calder.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Wadi Mode.
Oh, no.
She is the latest winner of the Augusta National Women's Amateur. A great finish to birdie to get the title. And so I've been in the Augusta area for a couple of days before we reconvene for the official Masters Preview podcast, the Golf Show podcast with Rex and Lav. What are you most looking forward to seeing over these next couple of days at Augusta National?
Well, Tiger Woods, I think he showed up today. It's Sunday at Augusta, and he was practicing. Like, I think we're all curious on that one. I think it is a sign of the times that there was a time when you and I would have never played golf on Sunday afternoon if there was a chance that Tiger Woods was going to show up at Augusta.
So RIP Tiger Tracker days. We miss you dearly.
That's right. It's not going to happen. I'm going to say that the excitement level going into this is only ratcheted up. And I was talking about this in a radio interview yesterday. I did. And it's because, well, twofold, or a couple reasons behind it. But one, it's been a long time since we were at the Open Championship and Brian Harman won a major. So the excitement level is always going to be the highest for this one because we spent the longest amount of time thinking about it, talking about it, looking forward to it. Like, you want to get here. You want to get on with it, as the English say. The other part of it is it's been a long time. It's been that long since all of the best players in the world were together. And I don't think we can gloss over that anymore. Like, these events have always been really important. They've always been the pinnacle of golf. But because of where we are right now in the state of the game, I think they've even taken on a greater importance.
And I think it's undeniable.
That
the majors have increased in stature just because of the friction in the game.
No doubt. Because this is the only place we're actually going to see an apples-to-apples comparison. We can sit here and say that, all right, Sergio played pretty well. He lost in a playoff this week in Miami. How would he compare?
What does it mean?
Like, and Rory finished third. So in your mind, you know, between those two players, which one you like more? Well, you can't. You can't wrap your mind around it because it's not. Like, this isn't transitive properties. You can't make this assessment anymore. Now, we don't have to worry about doing that. And this starts a very fast and furious major championship season. That's the part that gets me. Like, okay, we're here now. And really, really quickly, we're going to be at Valhalla for the PGA Championship, and then we're going to be at Pinehurst for the U.S. Open. And we're going to get an idea of exactly where the state of the game is really quickly.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. The curiosity factor is always so high, not just because of the gap between major championships, but just now the division between the players and reconvening them. It does certainly feel, Rex, like the animosity level has been lowered. Obviously, that's a byproduct of what happened on June 6th and the framework agreement and the two sides working towards a definitive agreement with the PGA Tour, the Saudi Public Investment Fund. There isn't quite the same level of tension, I would say, between the two warring sides. Remember last year, we would go to the tournament practice area and see kind of how the interactions were between LIV players, would they walk down to the range, or the PGA Tour players, would they greet each other, would they not? Rory and Brooks played a practice round at Augusta National. Everyone's like, what the heck is going on here? Like, there was so much, I think, outward curiosity and fascination between how the two sides were going to interact. Obviously, it did not come to fruition. There was no real tension in that respect. You know, John Rahm and Brooks Koepka went head to head, but I don't think anyone viewed that as PGA Tour versus LIV. It was two great players, two potential generational talents going head to head at Augusta National. And I think that was great theater. And so I think that element has been reduced a little bit, but the curiosity factor is as high as ever on how these two players and how these two sides and those groups of players are going to perform in a major championship. And I think the big storyline at this Masters in particular, Rex, is Scottie Scheffler. To me, he's storyline A, B, and C. Who can step up and beat Scottie Scheffler?
John Rahm's a defending champion. Like, I think that's being a little
bit. But Scottie Scheffler has played head and shoulders above everyone. I know Liv, it's not a head-to-head comparison, but they do have strokes gained metrics. And Scottie Scheffler, compared to his peers, is on a Tiger-like trajectory this season in 2024. Like, we have not seen this since Tiger 06, 07. And so the storyline this week is who could beat Scottie Scheffler. We're not going to get those answers in the next 3 days before we do our podcast, but I think we can at least have some more to chew on than we do right now.
Well, podcast on Wednesday and then mini pods Thursday, Friday,
of course,
Saturday, Sunday.
We will be back with mini pods. The timing, of course, will be a little bit interesting. You'll be on the live from post game each and every round, so we'll most likely be doing it back here at the Augusta House, where the Wi-Fi does seem strong. Did not have too many issues. If we did have an issue and it's buffering on YouTube, our sincere apologies. But that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. You guys know the drill. Go to nbcsports.com/golf for all the latest news and updates. Rex and I'll be filing beginning on Monday. Rex and I will also be on live from like 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern time on Monday to do our usual song and dance. I've got a Victor Hovland feature that'll be airing on Tuesday night that I hope you guys enjoy. So there's plenty to chew on. We'll be giving you all the information and hopefully making this podcast as good as possible. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. See you in a couple of days.
Thank you, Brooks. You're the best.